From TexasObserver.org and KOOP, this is Observer Radio, a half-hour discussion of Texas politics and culture with the staff and friends of the Texas Observer magazine. I'm your host, Patrick Michaels, and I'm joined this week by Observer contributor Rachel Pearson. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Observer's political reporter, Christopher Hooks. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Patrick.
And Andrea Grimes, an Observer columnist and senior political reporter for RH Reality Check.
Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Andrea. And on this week's show, we're discussing Andrea's great cover story for the Observer's November issue. It's called Not Your Daddy's Deer Lease, and it tracks the rise of a new mode of hunting in a state that loves guns almost as much as the rest of the country loves to joke about its love of guns. But first, earlier this month, Governor Rick Perry added Texas to the list of states with a lengthy and mandatory quarantine for healthcare workers returning from Ebola-stricken parts of West Africa. These three-week quarantines for volunteers who don't even have symptoms of the disease have been derided as purely political moves rooted in fear and pseudoscience, with the additional risk of dissuading volunteers who might otherwise want to volunteer and offer much-needed help. That's a starting point for Rachel Pearson's latest piece for The Observer. Rachel is not a doctor quite yet, in med school now.
That's correct.
Can't call you Dr. Pearson, but a frequent Observer contributor on issues, particularly on healthcare. So I'm interested how much this quarantine that Texas has put in place has been used. I know of at least one case I read about where there was somebody coming back from West Africa that was quarantined voluntarily. I think they went along with it. Do you know of many cases where this has come up?
It's not entirely clear how many people have been quarantined. The DSHS, the Department of State Health Services, definitely have that data, but that wasn't one of the questions that I asked them. The reason I was concerned about it, though, is because multiple people that I know have been thinking about volunteering to go to Sierra Leone or have volunteered, and when the state announced that they were going to do a mandatory quarantine that's stricter than what the CDC recommends, and that, you know, in the opinions of many experts is unnecessary from a safety standpoint, people thinking about volunteering started saying, whoa, that's very discouraging. It means three more weeks off work if you do volunteer. And also it means that the state, instead of treating providers like, I don't think any providers want to be treated like heroes, but I do think they want to be treated with respect. And then the state is making this decision that makes people feel like pariahs, and it's not based on science.
I was interested when the one nurse from Austin returned from Sierra Leone and subjected herself to a mandatory 21-day quarantine. Rick Perry did call her heroic for doing that, unlike the Casey Hickox riding her bike around Maine and sort of thumbing her nose at the governors. You're saying that there's a degree of heroism that's you don't want to lose your job if you want to volunteer and help out, and this makes it a lot harder to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And the folks who volunteer, a lot of them just feel like they have a duty to do so. For example, in Texas, a lot of medical students do rotations in various countries in Africa while they're medical students. And so they get their medical knowledge in part from training in Africa, from learning on this population of people. And then they bring that knowledge back, and it mostly benefits American patients. But because they got that training and because they, feel a connection to the place, they feel like a particular duty to volunteer and to help out, when there's a need in West Africa. It's really not anything heroic for a healthcare provider. You're not supposed to run away from infectious disease. You're supposed to be the person who's there. They train us in medical school, actually, that part of the ethic of being a provider is that, say, a bad infectious disease strikes Austin, I can send my husband away, but I have to stay. And that's just part of the hazard of the profession. Now, to actually go abroad to do something like treat Ebola patients is above and beyond the call of duty for most people, but it is something that providers here feel called to do, and that will benefit patients both in West Africa and could benefit patients here. Certainly stopping the epidemic has like tangible benefit for folks here in Texas. And so, you know, it's really like not so much heroism as it is duty, although Rick Perry calling that nurse a hero, I think he's really, that was very diplomatic.
I caught a suggestion, and it was subtle in your piece, that there might be some people who are interested in politicizing the Ebola issue for their own interests that maybe didn't run in keeping with the best science out there.
Yeah. So one of my favorite things about the governor is his ability to I'm being sarcastic, and I hope it comes through on the radio.
I think that covers it right there.
To turn any issue into a way to militarize the border. And Ebola was certainly one of those. You know, he not only called for a travel ban, but also tried to make this into an excuse to militarize the border. And with health and with infectious disease in particular, we really are all connected. And so militarizing the border or, you know, trying to like close off the walls, in the long run, it can put us all at risk because it prevents us from providing the care and providing the services that, you know, stop infectious disease.
This is sort of like when the kids were coming across from Central America over the summer and earlier this year, it was the same sort of talk about, you know, what's going to happen in our schools when these kids, you know, who are actually vaccinated better than American kids, it turns out, are coming in, or that sort of fear of
There's a lot of fear of outsiders, and a lot of the rhetoric around Ebola in the States has centered on this fear of outsiders. I think we run a risk when we base our health policy on fear rather than on what's epidemiologically sound, what's backed up by the CDC, and what is evidence-based. So with respect to the Central American kids, everybody, myself included, was very surprised to learn that they are more likely to be vaccinated. But, you know, again, just like we need to make these policies based on data, not based on fear of outsiders.
It's like the science lives in one world and the politics live in the other. And you, I mean, at the end of your piece here, you tie it into how many people in Texas are uninsured. And that if you're really interested in like keeping everybody safe and minimizing the risks to everybody, then you want to make sure that as much of the population as possible is just getting good health care and preventative care and getting treated all the time.
Yeah. You know, the issue of what happened with Thomas Eric Duncan is really interesting because he was turned away from the ER the first time he went after he was infected with Ebola. And that probably had to do with his insurance status. I mean, he was seen at the ER, but he wasn't admitted to the hospital. And so the hospital knew if you take in an uninsured patient, the hospital loses money. And then I think, you know, it also has to do with race. Physicians are much less likely to take seriously the pain of African-American people. I mean, like the physical pain. So there's a lot of data showing that physicians consistently undertreat pain in African-Americans. Physicians ignore pain. There's this crazy study out of Atlanta, not to get too far off subject, but the study that looked at men coming into an ER with long bone fractures, so like fractured legs, fractured arms, and race, like the data stratified by race in terms of how likely physicians were to treat pain. And there were African-American men who came in with broken legs and did not get pain control in the study. So there's like, what strikes me about Duncan is like his insurance status and then also the fact that he was African like definitely we need to be insuring people, but also as a community of providers, like as physicians, we need to talk about how seriously we take pain in African Americans, because Thomas Eric Duncan, he rated his pain an 8 out of 10, which is pretty high, and much, much more pain than you would expect to see in a patient with just like a bacterial infection, which is what they thought he had. So there's really like a lot of issues in there, a lot of problems with how healthcare providers in general, but like the Texas healthcare system in particular addresses the issues of the uninsured and underserved.
Yeah, there's another interesting thing that you raised in your story, and it's about the history of quarantines and this sort of impulse to like batten down the hatches and just take care of your own. You talked about the early days of quarantines in the 14th century and the Black Death. How would you put the quarantine policy we see in the United States now? How do you compare that to how quarantines began back then?
Well, when I started researching this story, I thought that contemporary quarantine was going to be very different from quarantine during the days of the Black Plague.
Because we know a lot more now. We're better at science.
We do know a lot more. But quarantine is still basically the same thing. Like when I talked to the folks at the Department of State Health Services, they were like, yeah, quarantine is basically just making someone stay home. There's not anything high tech about it. Now, so the act of quarantining someone is pretty much the same. And then also the social role that quarantine can play in terms of isolating people, in terms of like defining who's in and who's out, and in terms of particularly like quarantine being more strictly applied to marginalized populations, like that is all still going on.
How did that play out in the early days of quarantining?
In all kinds of ways. Like in Florence during the time of the plague, they basically like walled off sections of the city where the poor live, and like so people couldn't get out. In the UK, which wouldn't have been the UK then, but England we'll call it, Daniel Defoe describes individual people's houses when one person became sick with the plague, whole houses being like nailed shut so that people who weren't sick couldn't get out. And quarantine also consistently has been enforced by police control. And so, you know, you would see like armed people or like police, you know, standing around outside quarantined houses to make sure no one, you know, went in or went out, or if anybody went in, they didn't come out. And that is still kind of how quarantine is enforced. So, for example, if a doctor comes back to Texas having treated Ebola patients in West Africa and then doesn't comply with the state mandated quarantine, they can be prosecuted. It can be enforced by the police and the criminal justice system.
Is that because that's the best tool for that, or is it that we haven't come up with anything better?
Well, you know, really the best tool is a well thought out quarantine based on science that, you know, people are willing to cooperate with. And that really is complicated. It depends on people trusting the government. It depends on the government actually having people's health and best interests at heart. And really it depends on just like a lot of trust. And in Texas, I do think the Department of State Health Services is doing the best they can, but they have to do what Rick Perry orders them to do. And we've seen Perry consistently making health policy decisions that aren't based on science and that aren't, in the best interests of Texan health. And so my own trust in the system is certainly not the best. And I just don't think that we have the kind of general trust in the government to have a quarantine that doesn't need to be enforced by the police, but that's going to be, you know, voluntary and people are just going to comply with.
How do you think we should make sense of the fact that the people that are most likely to use public health scares as a political weapon are also the people that want to keep the public health system weak or weaker?
I would like to see health policy decisions that were really based on an ethics of care, based on science and based on an ethics of care, based on an idea that we should be caring for each other and that that will make us safer. The government has this tendency, or the Texas government right now has this tendency to, at the same time, scare everybody into a tizzy and say we need to shut down all flights from West Africa, and then turn around and not fund the departments that are actually going to do the sort of on the ground work, you know, that keeps people safe and that stops infectious disease. You know, the infectious diseases we really need to be worrying about here are things like flu, that kills, you know, thousands of people every year. And things like tuberculosis, which while tuberculosis doesn't spread very quickly, we do have like a pretty high TB rate here in Texas in the prisons on the border. And we need a good, well-funded like state health department to make sure that stuff can stay under control. But yeah, it's really contradictory. I mean, I'm not quite sure how to make sense of it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio from the Texas Observer and KOOP Radio in Austin. Jesse Griffiths is the hunter-gatherer entrepreneur behind Austin's Dai Due Butcher Shop and Restaurant, and the author of Afield, a chef's guide to preparing and cooking wild game and fish, which guides home cooks through dressing and preparing everything from turkey to feral hog to squirrel. And I was just reading in Texas Monthly, he was described this month by Pat Sharp as a village elder or a friendly brown bear. He's a main subject in Andrea Grimes' latest piece for The Observer about the local food movement in DIY culture and how they've converged around Texas' old love for the hunt. This is our Butterball Hotline from Hell this Thanksgiving week. We've got Andrea here to read a little bit about this phenomenon from her story.
Sure. So this is an excerpt from my piece. Griffiths says, more and more people do seem to be picking up shotguns and rifles, and they're not necessarily beer-swilling bubbas who hole up in $1,300 camouflage blinds and draw game into range with deer corn. These are people taking a step beyond CSA delivery and backyard chicken coops, following the path of locally sourced eating to the next level. That path originates at a convergence of a lot of obnoxious gastronomical buzzwords floating around menus and recipe blogs these days, locavore, sustainable, seasonal, and a Michael Pollan-esque fast food nation-inspired distrust of large-scale factory farming and ranching. That's a demographic, says Griffiths. They're 25 to 35, they like music, food, art, they're socially minded, whatever that might mean, they're interested in hunting, and maybe they weren't 5 years ago, but they are now.
So in your our own particular bespoke artisanal fashion, can you render a description of how this trend came about, if it's really such a recent thing?
I do think the current inclination towards local eating, sustainable eating, seasonal eating, you can't talk about this without these buzzwords, and they are buzzwords. I do think it comes out of an increased amount of information about the way we eat, where our food comes from. I think that there's more information available now about factory farms. I think that people are trying to be smarter about not, you know, eating a lot of fast food, both because the food itself is not nutritionally great, and also because the fast food industry treats its workers so poorly in so many cases. I think people are just trying to be a little more thoughtful about what they eat and where their food comes from. And I think that that does come out of a more recent kind of widespread push in the media and in, you know, we see feature films, documentary films, just to kind of have this conversation.
So in there's sort of a shorthand when we talk about your story around the office or, you know, looking at the magazine, we talk about it's the hipster hunter's story.
Uh-huh.
It's the hipster hunter's cover. but we don't use that phrase in the story, I think, for a reason. And I'm interested in why what you're talking about is not exactly hipsters hunting, but something a little bit different.
Well, really, the story is about people who go beyond a trend. And so, you know, I'm reluctant to use the phrase hipster hunters because that, you know, implies that the folks that I'm writing about here are going to drop hunting the way a hipster might drop skinny jeans, you know, when bootcut comes back into style. These are people who really are recreating new kinds of lifestyles around the way they eat, around the way they feed their families, around the way that they spend their leisure time. They're really taking on an identity that is tied up with where their food comes from. So, you know, to say it's hipstery, I mean, that's tempting because certainly the folks that I'm writing about, you know, tend to be pretty with it. They're not dorky people, generally speaking. They're actually like pretty cool people. You know, Jesse Griffiths has the Austin beard and is, you know, Dai Due is a beautiful butcher shop and restaurant. You know, it's very contemporary looking. It's very modern and sleek. You know, at the same time, he's out running around in the woods shooting deer and slaughtering them and processing them, you know, in an hour and a half. You know, this is how he lives his life, you know, in all ways. It's part of his work. It's part of his leisure. It's part of the way he interacts with his family. And, you know, the same goes for Jill Carroll, who I interview for this story as well. You know, she hunts doves and, you know, she'll shoot that dove at 4 o'clock, and at 7 o'clock, she and her wife are grilling and they're teaching their son to eat these organic, you know, sustainable types of foods. They teach their son about, you know, foraging and what plants you can eat from your yard. And these are people that live in like suburban Houston. You know, it's a really kind of interesting dichotomy between people who are kind of your average folks that you don't think of as being, you know, as I wrote in the story, Bubba's out there in deer blinds, and people who are really interested in sustainable food and just want to like do better for the world generally. And I think that for them that starts at home and it is a lifestyle.
There's something that comes up when you talk about Jill Carroll, who you describe as a philosopher writer outside Houston. You go out on her deer lease hunting with her at one point.
Dove lease.
It's a dove lease.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's it's not cheap, right? I mean, there's a privilege that comes with being able to do this and not eating fast food all the time. I mean, you address that a little bit in your piece as well, that this isn't a sort of lifestyle that's open to everybody, even though, you know, you might imagine this is the thing you'd do at one point was you'd go and shoot your own meat because you couldn't afford to buy it in the store. This sort of thing, the way that Texas is set up now, it is actually a pretty expensive thing to be doing.
Yes, definitely. You know, just kind of getting any time to be able to go out on somebody's lease and hunt can be hundreds of dollars for a really kind of fancy setup. We're talking thousands of dollars, many thousands of dollars. You know, Jill splits her lease with a number of other people so that they're all able to afford it and share it together. And, you know, Jesse Griffiths talked about, you know, in his, when I was speaking with him, he said, you know, he kind of was apprehensive about the hunting and fishing thing. Fishing was fine. Fishing was cheap, but hunting's expensive. And so he was a little bit, felt like he might be an outsider, felt like he might not be able to get into it until he had some real money to invest in equipment and the lease and these kinds of things. But there are so many more, I think, resources available today, in particular in Texas, where folks can take the opportunity to hunt without making these big investments. There are places like Broken Arrow Ranch that open up their, you know, sprawling acres to folks that want to come and shoot for a little while, and they'll teach you how to process your game and all of these kinds of things. So there, it can be more accessible. It's still very much a class issue here. You know, when I talked to Jill Carroll, she talked about growing up in Deep East Texas and hunting with her mom because they were broke. They could not go to the grocery store and buy these meats. They farmed. They hunt because they had to. And she grew up knowing how to hunt because of that. But then as she moved away from, you know, kind of that area and her family and became, you know, a college student. Now she's a doctor, you know, she's a writer, she's a novelist. You know, she moved away from that lifestyle because she didn't need to hunt for food anymore and only really kind of moved back into it later on in life once she could afford to do it. And once, you know, there were these resources available to help her figure out how to eat all of this food that she now had access to. But, you know, it's difficult to talk about because it's difficult to cast these folks only as kind of affluent, white, do-gooder types. Certainly there are people in this crowd that are like that, like absolutely. But at the same time, I think that, you know, it, you take the Seegers, who I also talk to here, and they've got a goat farm outside of Houston. You know, they're living it. This is not something that people are dipping their toes into. You know, this is Christian and Lisa like hanging out with their goats all the time. They haven't had a vacation in years because they can't leave their goats. They're making cheese to sell at farmers markets. You know, now they're getting into raising some other kinds of animals there at the farm. And they're doing it with an eye toward affordability, sustainability, and a sense of sharing with people in their community as well. So certainly there's the, you know, kind of silliness of paying, I don't know, $25 for a little wedge of goat cheese at the farmer's market because it's organic or whatever. But, you know, the Seegers and Jill Carroll and Jesse all have this kind of sense that what they're doing, the information they have, the lifestyle that they live is something they need to share with other people, not in an evangelical kind of I'm better than you, you're crappy for eating factory farmed meat kind of way, but in a way that they genuinely want people to have the relationship with food that they have in a way that is good for the environment and good for their bodies.
Do you think that they see themselves as a distinct subset or a group apart from hunters? Or is this really sort of a frame we're putting on this to be able to understand sort of a new type of movement?
I certainly think that Jill Carroll sees herself as not the average hunter. You know, she told me when I went out and sat and looked at doves with her for 5 hours on a Sunday, you know, she talked about shooters versus hunters. And, you know, the guys that go out with their, you know, expensive deer blinds and their, you know, high-powered guns and the guys that are really about the equipment and the stuff of hunting, you know, she calls those people shooters and people who do what she does, hunters, you know. She never takes a shot if she doesn't have like a 99% chance, in her opinion, of making it. You know, she doesn't just willy-nilly go out there to, you know, for pure sport, although she is a sportswoman. I mean, she really is thoughtful about the way she shoots and what her relationship is to the birds that she takes home. And, you know, she feels a real sense, I think, of communing with nature when she is out on her lease. You know, she's a novelist, she's a writer, she's a theologian. She's really, really thoughtful and talks in really interesting ways about what it's like to just like sit on that pond in her kayak and watch the ducks go by. And it's all night and the sun sets or it's rising. And then she takes that one shot where she knows she can get the animal. And that's it. You know, there's nothing aggressive about what she's doing. And I think that maybe is the difference between what we think of as kind of the natty light guy that just wants the, you know, buck, and Jesse and Christian and Lisa and Jill, who are out there you know, because they really feel like they want this connection to nature and want to understand better kind of where they are in the food chain.
Well, thanks, Andrea and Chris and Rachel.
Thanks.
And that's it for this week's episode of Observer Radio. You'll find links to the stories we discussed with our show notes at texasobserver.org. Thanks, as always, to Rosie and the Ramblers for providing the music for our show. And thanks to all you listeners. For more sharp reporting from the strangest state in the union, visit us at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of The Observer at fine booksellers around the state.